This tape is about the September 11 tragedy and its aftermath. For the next little while, Chris and I will apply Dr. Claire W. Graves' theory and SD to look at some of the dynamics. We'll editorialize, and although some of what we say might be controversial, our goal is to stimulate thinking and dialogue.
As we record this on October 30, 2001, the fourth week of military attacks is underway against Afghanistan. The president has tacked up more posters. Wanted, dead or alive, Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. Saddam Hussein still lurks in the background.
The nation struggles with bioterrorism and the nagging concern that it might be domestic, not imported. The FBI keeps warning of more terrorism to come, trying to balance crying wolf against preparedness.
Well, we want to put 9/11 into a more Gravesian context.
And as a refresher, here's one of his summaries. I'll insert the Spiral Dynamics colors, and we'll expand on it shortly.
At each stage of human existence, the adult man is off on his quest of his holy grail, the way of life he seeks by which to live. At his first level,
beige,
he is on a quest for automatic physiological satisfaction. At the second level,
purple,
he seeks a safe mode of living. And this is followed in turn by a search for heroic status, for power and glory,
red,
by a search for ultimate peace,
blue,
a search for material pleasure,
orange,
a search for affectionate relations,
green,
a search for respect of self,
yellow,
and a search for peace in an incomprehensible world,
turquoise.
And when he finds he will not find that peace, he will be off on his ninth level quest,
coral.
As he sets off on each quest, he believes he will find the answer to his existence. Yet much to his surprise and much to his dismay, he finds at every stage that the solution to existence is not the solution he has come to find. Every stage he reaches leaves him disconcerted and perplexed. It is simply that as he solves one set of human problems, he finds a new set in their place. The quest, he finds, is never-ending.
Each system is made up of two interactive elements. First, the external life conditions that people confront. It consists of the existence problems, the context of historic times, the physical place, and sociocultural circumstances, and we'll talk a lot about those.
The other piece is the mind capacities, neurological structures and psychophysical tools that set up our logical frames, language, and regulate behavior for coping with that external world. This includes genetics, biology, and even collective consciousness.
It's this combination of nature and nurture which makes a Gravesian system and a terrorist. It's the interplay among the two that shifts life conditions, then activates new neurology, and that in turn changes worldviews and makes terrorism stop.
We've got to understand why 9/11 happened, what motivates terrorists, and how to respond quickly and appropriately.
Not to make excuses or punish ourselves, but to solve a human problem.
So while the whole Gravesian spiral is in play here, the bulk of the energy seems to be coming from two levels of psychological existence, blue and orange. We suspect that on 9/11, fanatical people centralized in entering blue, nodal blue, and the blue to orange transitions attacked our big orange economic and military symbols.
And now they're getting the predictable retribution from our orange-blue stacked government and a president enjoying 90% plus approval ratings.
On the heavier orange side, special interests in both parties and some businesses are capitalizing pretty shamelessly on the nation's fear and indignation.
The peace movement demonstrates more green and yellow. In the flurry of shock, grief, and then anger over 9/11, it's been marginalized. Watch for a surge of activity presenting alternatives to war, though, as cultural creatives, the term coined by Paul Ray and Sherry Anderson for the exiting orange to green and into yellow zone, as they stop mourning and gather momentum.
And look to Europe for a backlash, too, especially from entering green, which can be tough in its own way. Protests over corporate warrior approach to world policy will continue, and they'll expand. And to be misread as red.
And look for purple in the tribal societies of Afghanistan and Central Asia, and red among the warlords and smugglers on the borders. The region was already in the midst of a civil war before we went in. Perfect conditions for terrorist boot camps.
Some pundits say terrorism comes from red thinking. We strongly disagree. That's a piece for sure, but there's much more to the puzzle.
Remember, the red worldview is characterized by unabashed self-assertiveness and heroic expressiveness. It's hedonistic and impulsive. There's a great fear of shame, an absence of guilt with cunning, hate, and aggression, which are often central to life, and people who show extreme sensitivity to external controls and resistance to authority in this system. And you'll find they attribute malevolent purpose or intent to others.
Terrorists are not impulsive or just aggressive people out for personal glory, acting for individual pleasure. Their violence is very purposeful. There's guilt and compliance to their authority. They can't be flamboyant and maintain a low profile to avoid detection. Terrorism takes more than red.
Remember, red is an express self impulsively system. Now consider these elements of blue, the deny self for reward later system. Accepting prescriptions of idealized higher authority with absolute obedience. Tests of worthiness to deserve peace in afterlife as directed by divine fate. It's a world filled with shoulds, oughts, musts, directives, and commandments. Guilt is centralized as a theme of existence, and the thinking is categorical, rigid, dogmatic, redundant, and judgmental. There's an intolerance of ambiguity, which means people need to think in polarities like black or white, either or, friend or foe, right or wrong. Absolutistic, dichotomous thinking.
People centralized in the sacrifice self blue worldview often concentrate on the glory of death and the life to come hereafter. Many terrorists seem to believe they have little to lose in dying and much to gain by fulfilling their missions.
They have faith that what they're doing is right and what they're fighting is evil.
From what we've been told and what we understand, the 9/11 terrorists were fairly restrained. They maintained secrecy. They weren't bragging too much about their plans. Even their bizarre night out on September 10th was modulated. They weren't crazy guys or just evil cowards of some sort. That's way too easy. There's much more to it.
While there might be an element of red in some individual terrorists, the design and execution of the 9/11 strategy definitely did not come from red.
It surely involved some entering blue and probably some cold-blooded orange, too. The operatives were organized and coordinated with a strategy. This was fanaticism, not red egocentrism.
Their intelligence gathering was effective. They got training in operating commercial jets. They slipped through lax airport security and understood airline procedures, so they were able to take over the cockpits with makeshift weapons. No high tech on 9/11, just technology used against itself.
Our high tech attacks on Afghanistan are probably going to lead to more terrorism. We can kill off some of today's terrorists, but we can't get them all. We're not fighting a snake or even a dragon. This is a hydra. Lopping off the head only creates two more in its place. Grudges and revenge last a long time in the purple and red worlds. Martyrdom energizes entering blue, and we won't get beyond violent stalemate while rigid nodal blue sees evil and enemies all around.
We had a chance to do it differently. Unfortunately, the victim role was lost once Uncle Sam went on the offensive before showing the evidence. We held the moral high ground and sacrificed it for a counterpunch that looks eerily like a replay of Gulf War footage.
We did need to inflate like a pufferfish and look strong and powerful and not going to take it, but all the meanwhile quietly, stealthily, and resolutely tracking down the criminals to take them out.
At the same time, we should be loudly demanding UN action by a solid alliance formed under broad principles of international law to find their backers, a world against terrorism. President Bush and Prime Minister Blair struck prematurely.
You know, the U.S. and the U.K. have plenty of military power to knock out terrorists, but terrorism doesn't respond to military power.
As in the cruder Clinton-Blair-led NATO attack on Yugoslavia, the guys with the big sticks and depleted uranium have used them. They're operating under the usual macho rules, fight or flight, strike back reflexively, hard and fast.
9/11 put America into shock, and we're still not thinking too clearly.
The White House tried to spin a president in hiding rather than just explain continuity of government. We shut down airlines, surrendered civil liberties and immigrants' rights, and succumbed to anthrax anxiety while Congress just hit the road. Despite the blue and purple heroism of rescue workers and the grief of victims' families, our overreaction has served the terrorists and their cause. They count on disrupting complacent citizens and comfortable governments by installing fear.
So we're living proof that it works. Flags, and some are getting kind of tattered, fly everywhere. War drums beat in the right-wing media. When Dan Rather stood up to salute the presidency, he waved some of the journalists' essential skepticism goodbye. Our business-oriented administration has twisted 9/11 from a terrible and an inexcusable crime into a protracted war.
Congress surrendered its responsibility early on and let the president send U.S. forces into harm's way without clarity of mission, vision, or oversight because debate now equals disloyalty. The essential separations have faded into Republicrat haze, with only a courageous few daring to ask about the emperor's new clothes.
There's too little room for alternatives to war or honest dissent.
the people's right to know has been set aside in the name of security. Now, it's need to know.
Homeland defense is the rage as freedom of information decays.
Under huge pressure to solve the case, Attorney General John Ashcroft has 1,000 people in anonymous custody, and that's not a good sign for democracy.
Benjamin Franklin said those who would sacrifice their liberty for security deserve neither.
Our challenge is to keep freedom and liberty from colliding with self-defense. Our present leaders are steeped in or logic. That means they think in terms of either freedom or national security.
Either government controls or laissez-faire market. Love it or leave it. Agreement or insubordination.
Many Americans live in the mid-range of the spiral, where clear, categorical, and unambiguous or logic prevails. It fits the exiting red, blue, orange, and even some of the entering into green worldviews.
But or logic precludes complex solutions. It only manages complicated ones. Simplistic solutions are a national weakness. We sort by patriot or traitor, Republican or Democrat, and then believer or infidel, saint or Satan. Or logic limits us to black or white in a complex world full of grays.
And color. Instead of relying on or, we have to think in terms of and, with questions like, how do we preserve civil liberties and have security? How do we have more and take less? How do we grow and reduce consumption? We have to learn how to start thinking about resolving these paradoxes.
And logic is inclusive. It lets us see many elements as a whole instead of at poles. We connect people, interests, and their needs so all get what they need without doing harm to the others. It's the logic that begins with authentic yellow and beyond.
Our democracy is currently threatened by too much compliant or and too little and.
The shift from or to and doesn't mean homogenizing differences. It means integrating them to gather strength from many perspectives while opening space for disagreement.
Following 9/11, the trustees of the City University of New York, like some other colleges, drafted a resolution condemning professors who criticize U.S. foreign policy. When teachers can't critique foreign policy, when the press is obedient rather than curious, and when spinmeisters are able to shut down political discussion with the fog of flag-waving demagoguery, then democracy becomes plutocracy or oligarchy.
And also in New York, Rudolph Giuliani has modeled the authentic, firm, and genuinely compassionate version of orange-blue leadership that many Americans have needed so badly while there have been so many funerals. There's been a kind of a vibrant love of country and a sense of unity that doesn't seem to have been matched since World War II. All over the world, the cry went up after the buildings came down, "Ich bin ein New Yorker." In many respects, American satisfaction with America has been toward a record high.
However, there's also been racist stereotyping of Arab Americans and some tragic hate crimes against people in Islamic dress or who look Middle Eastern. It's a throwback to our treatment of Japanese Americans in World War II. We're far too quick to point and profile based on appearances and stereotypes when hunting for witches.
More or logic.
In our view, 9/11 produced a regression towards blue on the spiral. Once the dust settles and we get enough of Afghanistan, the U.S. will get back to the orange business of salvaging the receding economy.
Orange thinking is materialistic and secular, one of the things that Osama has against us. We're multiplistic. That means there are many ways to do a thing, but one best way. Still into or logic. In orange, there's often disdain for empathy. You can expect harsh criticism that cuts opponents up with language. The individual or group doesn't change as a result of feedback. Only what it decides for itself, and often despite contrary evidence coming in. Orange craves choices, like an American supermarket, and also lots of data before picking the winner. To orange, authority and laws are restrictive but necessary. It doesn't project the malevolent intent onto rules and other people like red does. And look out for an inflative sense of achievement and ego with a strong reliance on the power of personality and contacts and connections to get things done, like, if I could be free to take things over, I could clear it up. Piece of cake.
Well, it's not always a piece of orange cake. If we consider the post-disaster airline bailout, for example, we see that it was a boon for the corporations and executives and a bust for the displaced workers.
Same thing applies for the insurance industry. They want to apply the act of war exclusion and jack up rates on tall buildings, sort of like some of the air carriers combing through the fine print of the Warsaw Convention to try and avoid claims for victims' families.
Only corporate shame, imposed by protests and consumer backlash, seems to stimulate reflection from corporate orange. Then, reputation management takes over.
And while we're on the airlines, it's obviously way past time for increased airport security. The inept FAA and the airline companies have knowingly gambled safety against profits for years. Now it's time to stop using unscreened minimum wage personnel for critical jobs. Professionals must fly and secure aircraft, which are now flying bombs.
Terrorism is an international issue, which requires a national system, maybe under the Customs Service. Some things are still the people's business, though, and we're learning that privatization isn't always the best long-term solution.
Trust, and sometimes the public's interest, disappear when competitiveness eliminates competition.
R. Orange assumes that any sensible human being wants what we do. Never dawns on us that some people think we're the evil ones for living the way we do, while so many do without. We need expensive gas-guzzling SUVs, after all. We need those Walmart goods made in sweatshops. We need $5 lattes made from coffee picked by child laborers. And we're blind to the distant impact of our needs on the people that we share this planet with.
Maybe we can do something. Body Shop's Anita Roddick is introducing a new book called Take It Personally. She remarks that business, the most powerful institutions in the world, must now show more developed emotions than simply fear and greed. The measure of good business goes beyond profit and loss to contribution. Activism is the rent we pay for living on this planet, and we must become active against exploitation so the few no longer live at the expense of the many or of the future.
A good starting point is to cure our addiction to fossil fuels. The Orange worldview is perfectly built for exploiting natural resources. With only 4% of the world's population and 3% of petroleum reserves, we Americans are the top consumers. We're oil junkies because of our addiction to growth and independence.
According to Kate Aubin of the U.S. Public Interest Research Group, 2/3 of our consumption is spawned by transportation. The EPA recently released figures which show that today's SUVs average 14 miles per gallon. Fuel economy is about the worst since 1980. Domestic oil production, however, peaked in 1970. Today we produce half as much. According to Ken DeFays, author of Hubbard's Peak, The Impending World Oil Shortage, production will max out around 2004, while demand, and largely due to the spread of Orange around the world, still will continue to grow.
How might our policies for capturing oil connect with terrorism? Well, according to the Rocky Mountain Institute, in the mid-1990s, the Pentagon and Department of Energy subsidized R&D in the fossil fuel industry to the tune of $300 million annually. At least $50 billion a year went to safeguard Middle Eastern oil fields and shipping lanes. We keep 25,000 troops provocatively stationed near Islam's holiest sites in Mecca and Medina to protect the Al Saud family's feudal monarchy against civil war with religious conservatives. We project military force to protect our national interests from foreign competitors in Saudi, and soon enough we'll see them around the Caspian Sea. The glaring presence of those forces just might provoke some bitter resentment.
How would we like foreign armies camped out in the District of Columbia?
You might not be aware of the plans to build a pipeline through Afghanistan.
When the Taliban took power in Kabul in 1996, the U.S. initially downplayed concerns about their poor human rights record. At that time, Unocal, Union Oil of California, was one of several firms competing to construct a pipeline through Afghanistan. They needed a stable government and tried to convince the Clinton administration to recognize the Taliban as legitimate rulers. Although Unocal pulled back temporarily because of the controversy over the Taliban's treatment of women, they're again pushing for rights to build that pipeline, and it'll be much easier with a docile regime in place.
The petrochemical age is burning out.
And that's bad news for the oil companies.
Just as they got the regulators pretty much in check, now they've got a customer revolt to worry about as green and yellow thinking begin to expand.
So Royal Dutch Shell and BP and others have already seen the handwriting on the pump and begun moving beyond petroleum.
Our president, vice president, and national security advisor all come from the traditional oil business. Are we more oiligarchy than democracy?
Think about it. Americans subsidize the oil company's corporate welfare with our taxes and our public lands. They've paid us back with windfall profits and conveniently neglected their royalties. Esso, Occidental, and others count on our overt and covert forces to help them operate, all so we can shoot up and get our daily oil fix.
And it's killing us.
A Harvard study claims that 30,000 Americans die every year from diseases stemming from car exhaust. Oil lubricates terrorism, and it's time for a cure.
If President Bush wants to leave a mark in history and change the world for the better, let him declare a war on our dependence on fossil fuels. just as President Kennedy issued a challenge to land a man on the moon in the 1960s, so President Bush can wean us from petroleum and the temperament of foreign leaders.
Begin by quadrupling fuel economy and efficiency of new cars within, say, 5 years. Then a Bush challenge to make petroleum secondary by developing energy alternatives, hydrogen, solar, tide, wind, geothermal, fusion, and a package of others by, say, 2010. Not by drilling holes in our irreplaceable wildlife preserves or contaminating our already endangered oceans to find a dribble more oil, but by creating incentives to stop consuming so much petroleum and to replace it with clean, inexhaustible sources of energy and get them online immediately.
That's the way to create national security.
But national security is just great for orange business. An astounding 60% of every American tax dollar goes to the Pentagon in the belief that the war paradigm is the way to guarantee access to energy.
And thereby guarantee security for our lifestyle.
So our military-industrial complex is a major chunk of our GNP, and maybe as much as 36% of our work goes to perpetuating the means of war. And it all works together. The armed forces need to practice every so often, just to be sure that everything on paper works in the field. Those displays of force are necessary marketing for the manufacturers, since the Pentagon demos our weapon systems.
Samples close sales on the global stage.
And we're the world's largest arms merchant.
The U.S. profitably supplied both sides in the Iran-Iraq war, while children fought and died.
We helped arm the Afghan Mujahideen when they were fighting the Soviets for us. Now the Taliban are using some of those same supplies against our own forces, while we arm the new guys, the Northern Alliance.
As happened in Somalia, the disposable armed forces became a crutch for the government when our foreign policy is clumsy. We depend on aircraft carriers and cruise missiles and put Marines' lives at risk far too easily when diplomacy and development aid are called for. Bombs don't blow away fanaticism and ideologies, but fanatics kill American soldiers, sailors, and air crews, just like they massacred civilians in their offices on 9/11.
Terrorism is cheap. These days, you don't have to be a nation-state to conduct a war. A clever movement with a little blood money in its pocket and some suicide soldiers can make a huge impact. An airplane, or now even an envelope, is a weapon.
Honorable nations and institutions have to cooperate worldwide to shut off the electronic money flow among terrorists and drug dealers, as surely as we need to keep plutonium and biological agents under control.
And although in some ways we are fighting a war like no other, this war on terrorism does have a lot in common with the old war on drugs. The enemy is hidden. Borders are fuzzy. Both are clandestine and corrupt. Both do damage to civil liberties. Both depend on people's pathologies.
The war on drugs undercut the Fourth Amendment search and seizure protections, the new anti-terrorism bill.
And who could have voted against the USA Patriotism Act?
Yeah, well, it'll erode the Constitution even further. Though the original was toned down by the anthrax-distracted Congress, it still echoes Tony Blair's new labor terrorism bill that went into effect in the UK in February 2001. And Canada's followed our lead as well. All contain newspeak definitions of terrorism, which are frightfully vague and far too inclusive.
Threatening to brand someone with the charge of terrorism supporter is quite an effective way to stifle dissent and muzzle contrary opinions on a wide range of issues, from international trade and corporate globalism to environmental protection and human rights.
All in the name of stopping terrorism, of course.
So our sincerest thanks and respect go to those few legislators who've had the courage to raise questions and make honest debate about all of this, and especially to oppose this ill-considered act.
The drug trade feeds terrorism. Alfred McCoy, in The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia, points out that 75% of the world's heroin is supplied by Afghanistan. In 1990, they'd shipped approximately 250 tons. The Taliban increased that to 4,600 tons by 1999.
We replaced a war on communism with a war on drugs. Now the war on terrorism is taking over from that.
McCoy says the drug war stimulated narcotics traffic rather than decreasing it. He notes that in 1972, about 100 tons of illegal drugs moved around the world. 6,000 tons were shipped in the year 2000. The drug war has been very good for business. Will the war on terrorism increase terrorism?
Since the nation's now in its let's fight mode, we can't forget about the space war either. The Bush administration has targeted the old space-based military as a priority. The new chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Myers, is a space warrior. National missile defense, an extension of an ongoing interest of U.S. policymakers dating back to Reagan's Star Wars episodes and before that.
National missile defense, which Dr. David Krieger of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation describes as a Maginot Line in the Sky in his book of the same name, It's been marketed as a protection against a technologically adept rogue state. Because of the 9/11 attack, even though NMD would have done absolutely nothing to defend the World Trade Center, we're going to still hear a lot of missile rattling as an argument to just get on with it.
Despite lots of pressure to go ahead with this and talk about comets and asteroids too, it's not too late to show some strength and change course on this one.
The president is absolutely right in that we can't tolerate attacks on innocent people on our soil. We have to respond. But neither should innocent people become collateral damage on theirs when we do.
Short-term orange wheeling and dealing, even public relations campaigns, doesn't address long-term humanitarian and ecological issues, and those are the big ones.
All too often, our all-volunteer military becomes a crutch for lazy and weak foreign policy. We resort to stealth aircraft and smart bombs, where diplomacy and collaborative development are called for.
Bombs don't kill fanaticism or wipe out ideologies.
While Tom Brokaw's Greatest Generation fought World War II, now is the time for boomers like Blair and Bush, and plus Gen X and Y and all the rest, to demonstrate a new kind of cross-generational greatness. 50 years later, it's time to change the world again, from limited either-or logic to a world of and.
If we don't shift strategy, then our children's children are going to live forever in fear and terrorism, revenge, and hatred simmer on across time.
A big part of the solution lies in making information available.
For the first couple of weeks after the attack on the World Trade Center in Pennsylvania and the Pentagon, the mainstream media were very good.
There was analysis, there was investigation. Talking heads who'd become corporate infotainment shills instead of journalists were reporters again. The major newspapers and magazines are still at it, but ignoring outrage by the peace movement that gets most of its domestic exposure via alternative media like Pacifica, NPR, PBS, Indie Media, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, and the Internet.
Primetime TV has largely slipped back into sitcoms and ratings contests with soft news survivor stories. Those 60 Minutes and the other Frontline and such are doing a pretty strong job.
Very little information is forthcoming from the Pentagon, obscuring the truth of this conflict even more than Bush the First's Desert Storm. Bush the Second promised clandestine operations and deception, which he's fulfilling. He's also made his covert war overt against the Taliban, and the media are letting that ride for fear of just seeming unpatriotic.
Back on September 23rd, we were promised that the evidence against Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, who's been painted as both religious fanatic and the Tony Robbins of terrorism, would be presented to the American people. We and much of the world are still waiting for that.
And we're expected to support the war without questions.
That's awfully obedient and awfully easy when blue is in control.
Whenever there's talk of restraint on the press, it's time for alarm.
We certainly don't want reporters to give away specific military details that would put our personnel at risk. Though that's really rarely happened, short of the Ultra thing in World War II and such. Still, it's the information lockdown and the purge of freedom of information that's really disturbing. Lack of analysis and understanding of the world out there is what got us into this mess.
There's been a frenzy of confusion over anthrax by mail, serious blunders by the uncoordinated CDC, FBI, and other agencies have been embarrassing and tragic. We're a leader in developing biological weapons in Maryland, just a few miles from Washington. But we weren't even prepared for a small attack? What's going to happen when genetic terrorism strikes?
And reporting on the failures of our intelligence agencies, CIA, FBI, NSA, DIA, NRO, and all the other alphabets, it's been fairly soft. On 9/11, Uncle Sam was caught with his pants down. Despite Echelon and all the satellites and all the intelligence systems, the spooks failed to detect an elaborate plan that had been hatching for a year or two, at least, despite warnings from foreign agencies, it seems.
Project Censored reports suppressed details of criminal insider trading leading directly into the CIA's highest ranks. Coincidentally, CIA Executive Director Buzzy Krongard, recently promoted by President Bush, formerly managed the firm handling the put options on United Airlines.
George Bush the Elder, a former CIA head himself, is a leading player in the Carlyle Group, which reportedly has ties to the Saudi Arabian rulers and the bin Laden family, not Osama. It now appears that 15 of the 19 operational 9/11 terrorists were from Saudi Arabia.
Why didn't analysts sense something happening?
Or did they, and did they make noise, and were they simply ignored?
These are big stories.
We stand for freedom and democracy at home, and often support oppressive regimes abroad, then wonder why people get put out with us.
The tacit agreement between the administration and the broadcast networks to censor video released by Osama bin Laden was a mistake. If we are the land of the free and the brave, why are we nervous about showing harangues from this guy to Americans? We should have the courage to face our enemies' words directly and strip them bare, up front and in public. No excuses about secret handshakes in the internet age.
Tiny Al Jazeera, the Arab TV network from Qatar, one of the Gulf states standing with us, is doing an impressive job providing coverage, often better than our own networks. Someone looking from outside could give us rather poor marks for not trusting the American people with a free flow of information.
The reaction to Bill Maher was telling. He remarked that the terrorists were many things, but they weren't cowards. He got a huge backlash, and although ABC did support him, if he can't make a politically incorrect comment, in a Gravesian observation, on his own show, politically incorrect, where has our freedom of speech gone?
Democracy depends on informed people. 80% of Americans get their information primarily from TV. So it's critical for that medium to be open, informative, curious, and courageous.
Useful reporting requires facts, plus a dose of skepticism, balanced orange thinking, objective analysis, and challenges to authority. As we should have learned from Vietnam, just rebroadcasting Pentagon briefings and pool reports is no way to cover a war or provide truth.
Not enough is said about the economic bailout bill that slithered through the House and hands the wealthiest citizens and big donor corporations a huge gift of tax relief. The congressional leadership has dusted off even more pork to try to slip it through the smokescreen of the World Trade Center. Bipartisan now seems to mean equally corrupt.
Meanwhile, echoing Blair's earlier orange advice to the Brits, President Bush sends ordinary Americans to the malls to spend, 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 and prove their patriotism, while many make do without health care. Seems to be business as usual.
Finally, and this comment won't be popular probably, we feel that the president exploited America's children a bit, and badly actually, with the send a dollar to the White House, 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue proposal. That to us is compassionate hypocrisy. And the latest Fight Fear with Friendship letter writing campaign, maybe while well-intentioned, came out bizarre. Afghan kids are having their hands that they write with blown off while they pick up yellow cluster bombs that look like food packets. How far out in right field is this White House anyway? And a lot of this stuff has largely gone unchallenged in the press.
Why isn't there a national call to teach nonviolent problem solving and more effective ways to listen and manage differences? Why expose another generation to the newspeak rhetoric of war is peace?
The president's advisors just don't seem to grasp green very much at all, much less yellow and beyond.
The sleazy behind-the-scenes maneuvering for fast-track trade rules that favor megacorporations, media consolidation, and undermining environmental protection in favor of industry just slither right by in the fog of war. Where are the questions?
And let's ask, what about George W. Bush's leadership?
Machiavelli wrote, "But one who against the people's wishes becomes prince by favor of the nobles should above all endeavor to gain the favor of the people. This will be easy to him if he protects them."
Despite the current polls and shouts of unanimous consent, this administration entered under a cloud. 9/11 cleared it.
The nation always rallies round the flag and the president in a sacrificial blue and tribal purple way in times of crisis, giving up sons and daughters and getting in line behind the leader.
Remember what the world was like for Mr. Bush before 9/11. He was struggling with a declining economy. There were questions about the Supreme Court. He was maneuvering with Congress and cutting lots of deals. He was sometimes inept and inarticulate. He took lots of vacation time.
The Florida vote count, now a vanishing story, was about to be released with who knows what consequences.
But like father, like son, both Bushes thrive on crisis. To paraphrase Dr. Samuel Johnson about the prospect of a hanging, a terrorist attack remarkably concentrates the mind, too.
President Bush's thinking seems to center in the blue-to-orange range, faith-based ideology and manipulative, shrewd, political calculation.
His language is revealing. The president stammers when he's talking about human issues and intense emotions frequently, but he's clear as a bell on matters of good and evil and punishment. According to Mark Crispin Miller, author of the Bush Dyslexicon, quote, "he's at his best when he's speaking cruelly," unquote.
Note the constant references to the evil ones and evil doers in his remarks. We've heard the phrase, lost a part of our soul and a calling, concepts from the blue world. Mr. Bush's use of the quickly retracted term crusade was a red flag in front of an angry bull, maybe a thoughtless slip, possibly a mistake, perhaps a bad strategy.
W. has stammered less than expected. He's read Mike Gerson's scripts competently and kept his campaign's near largely in check. Wishful critics are projecting substance even when it isn't there. like the reviews of his speech before Congress, and they applaud mere adequacy because expectations were frankly so low. He gets stature points for looking good, and has been called statesmanly and Churchillian by a press that's really desperate for leadership in a country that's hungry for a savior. The New York Times has actually anointed our often personable shrub with gravitas.
As long as he sticks to the scripts and then keeps quiet, he's fine. It's when Mr. Bush speaks on his own, or tries to be funny, that we see the inexperience, inflexibility, and mean-spiritedness at the top. The unscripted Bush repeats platitudes, mutters non sequiturs, and makes veiled, bellicose threats.
Under pressure and off the cuff, we tend to see the Bush patrician orange come out strongly through the veneer of blue, and a bit of kick-ass Texas red as a backup. You'll see that in his smoke 'em out and we want Osama dead or alive and you're either with us or against us stuff. Shoot first, ask questions later. It's the fry 'em and hang 'em high sheriff talking here.
And then there's the deputies. Cheney, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, and Powell, probably the most complex thinker of the bunch. They're an executive branch of retreads. Why did Bush choose them?
Because retread equals tried and true experience and proven competence. There's loyalty to the country, the party, and the family. That's how Orange likes to work. Their status and prestige are self-evident. They have credentials. It's consistent with the decision-making system for that blue and orange worldview.
George Bush's heavy blue, or statements that match Osama bin Laden, we are righteous and they are evil, we speak truth and they lie.
Yet the real enemy of truth is not the lie, but the myth. If we elevate the reputation of bin Laden as evil incarnate, or even a worthy foe, as Mr. Clinton quipped, instead of just laying out the facts openly and honestly so he reveals his own pathology, we're promoting the monster.
If we make martyrs of bin Laden and others, we'll reach the same impasse that keeps the West Bank in flames, Northern Ireland rocky, Saudi Arabia fragile, and many African states merely swapping despots, dichotomous, absolutistic, self-righteous thinking just recycled over and over again.
Dr. Graves once said that the blue worldview is at once the most peaceful and the most warlike of the systems.
Given all of this, the Bush-Cheney declaration of an Orwellian state of perpetual war against terrorism, rather than a well-crafted demand for international justice under international law in an emergency, really comes as no surprise.
Despite the escalation of a heinous crime into an act of war, pundits credit Mr. Bush with reasonableness, restraint, and a conciliatory tone. Journalists, who have caught the contagion of fear of inquiry, hesitate to critique the commander-in-chief.
Well, his style of leadership certainly works for people centralized in the blue-to-orange zone, where most of America lives.
However, there is a growing split amongst worldviews in our country. Many of the cultural creatives find Bush's leadership Machiavellian. In Gravesian terms, this group consists of those exiting orange, entering green, and entering yellow. Let's think about those worldviews for a moment.
In green, the centrality of life is people and serving them. Whereas control is necessary, it's not through authority or power, but through the people and the situation. Real compassion and empathy, not sympathy or manipulation. Green will say something like, each to his own. Others have their way, we have ours. It's not mine to judge. Words and fuzzy ideas often bog it down. Green emphasizes the importance of spirituality as well as religion in human existence, and it's negative towards anything that hurts other people. It's essentially an open and honest system, and that's difficult for some.
Yellow uses and logic to connect feelings with knowledge, and then acts on principles. They'll not stop from doing something that needs doing, even if it might hurt somebody's feelings. The person is able to be critical and act without rancor, strong without becoming emotionally hooked or trapped by ego. They minimize their footprints. They want to do no harm by their living. And they don't interfere with others unless it's necessary for the future. With impulsivity and compulsivity largely absent and fear pretty much gone, yellow allows other people their point of view while maintaining his or her own. Though also situationalistic and relativistic, like green, yellow knows where it stands.
For these people, solutions to human existence do not lie with killing and destroying. Another Texas president who got caught in a war, Lyndon Johnson, said, "The guns and bombs, the rockets and the warships, all are symbols of human failure."
The real solutions aren't sexy. Food supplies, education, healthcare, housing, exchange programs, along with lots of directed dialogue and sequential development, plus some quiet house cleaning of the real dangerous bad guys. No flashbang, no nightscope video, just resolve and determination. While this very few terrorists really are distracting us, infinitely more people are dying around the world from poverty, exploitation, and environmental devastation. To stop terrorist movements, we've got to stop those things that enable it.
Satiate and resolve existential problems where they are, to shift towards positive behavior within the system. Then, gently introduce the challenges from the next ones in their proper turn.
If there is a positive side to any of this, it might just be that human nature is taking the regressive step before a leap forward. Maybe the U.S. is about to escape its extremes of orange, while religious schisms sort themselves out for blue around the world.
The tragedy of 9/11 could actually be a turning point in world history, if Machiavelli stays out of it. If all the people who talk about transforming consciousness can work together to shift the energy of the planet, both ethereally and physically, to manifest peace, then everything can be changed.
Greg Braden, Larry Dossey, the Dalai Lama, and all the rest may really just be onto something. But for now, blue, orange, and a little bit of red are in charge. The Bush administration's ill-defined mission has crept from seeking justice for criminals that killed over 5,000 on 9/11 into a protracted war against the Taliban and assorted other enemies that threatens millions for years to come. While the U.S. tries to sort out an exit strategy on the fly from the confusing Afghan front, which is probably only one front of many, the region's winter and politics turn more ominous every day. Anti-American fighters stream in through Pakistan and Iran, past a river of desperate refugees flowing the other way.
Are 9/11 casualties or collateral damage from misguided U.S. foreign policy? According to Chalmers Johnson, author of the book Blowback.
Blowback means the unintended consequences of policies that were kept secret from the American people. Our clandestine interventions focus on the short term. Even if they do change an immediate problem, planners often don't take into account the repercussions that will come back to haunt us in 10, 20, or 50 years.
Johnson says what the daily press reports as the malign acts of terrorists, or drug lords, or rogue states, or illegal arms merchants often turn out to be blowback from earlier American operations. What U.S. officials denounce as unprovoked terrorist attacks on its innocent citizens are often meant as retaliation for previous American imperial actions. Blowback itself can lead to more blowback in a spiral of destructive behavior.
We're caught up in that hateful spiral right now, with both the war on drugs and the war on terrorism. Ask the question, why does a large part of the world not believe or trust us? Is it our democracy and our individual liberties and freedoms, as the president claims? Is it our wealth? Are they jealous of us? Or do they really even hate all Americans?
No. Take Xanana Gusmao, leader of East Timor, for instance. He was asked, do you hate Americans, since we supplied Indonesia with the weapons that resulted in the genocide of your people? He replied, no, we like Americans. It's your government we hate. This has been a refrain heard all over the world. The world doesn't hate us, the people. They hate what our government is doing in our name.
Here's one reason. We put less than 1% of our national budget into foreign affairs. And that's a choice of us, the people, because we run the government. It shows, though, how dialogue and empowerment compare to the military solutions and our priorities.
Let's face it. We invest far more on mafia-like credibility and shows of force than on diplomacy.
The USA is in a love-hate relationship with much of the world. We can improve that by closing some of the gaps between our rhetoric and our actions. All too often, our practice has been pragmatism. We align with whoever best supports our interests, be it a despot, democrat, or dictator.
As in Chile, we've been known to overthrow democracies in favor of a tyrant or puppet regime that serves our needs. Look at Nicaragua, Panama, Iran, and other places where our creations came back to bite us.
We helped set up Saddam Hussein and gave him chemical warfare tools. But since we tried to undo him and stopped short in 1991, 1.5 million Iraqis have been killed through regular bombings and the effects of sanctions. Most of these were children. Roughly 5,000 die every month from dysentery. Our puny sanctions kill kids while arrogant dictatorial bully kicks UN inspectors right back in our face.
Madeleine Albright demonstrated our orange arrogance that infuriates so many people when she said the thousands of dead Iraqi children were, quote, worth it.
If we intend to undo the forces that produce terrorism for the long haul, the U.S. has to face up to some pretty hard truths.
We also have to accept that all the world's not like us. Most Americans, even our diplomats, haven't got a clue about societies which are based on ancient customs and extended kinship, where blood is thicker than legal codes or politics, and the economy is based on barter and bazaar merchants, not WTO policies.
We can't fathom cultures that hide their women or mutilate little girls. we're surprised by honor codes that stretch back across generations. Like the Albanians in Kosovo, many Afghans share the law of hospitality and the law of revenge. An Afghan said, "I took revenge after 100 years, and that was too soon."
Our instant gratification, high-speed culture has a lot of orange-red. Much of the world lives in patient purple and blue, with orange yet to come.
Alexis de Tocqueville discussed our cultural myopia and democracy in America almost 200 years ago when he noted an interrelation between the religious spirit and the strength of the capitalist impulse. In essence, he was observing the dynamic partnership that forms between blue and orange. He said the single-minded pursuit of wealth and personal property was closely linked with the single-minded quest for God. He concluded the passion for individual autonomy is socially disintegrating.
The focus on orange individualism in a globally interconnected world creates dissonance with collective societies. Our secularism and materialism are threatening to theocrats and zealots. Orthodoxy hates heterodoxy.
9/11 grows from the stress between orange and blue. Bin Laden has threatened, quote, "I swear by God that America and those who live in America won't dream of having security before we have it in Palestine and all infidel armies depart from the land of Mohammed," unquote. He seems to frame us and the Israelis as terrorists like himself, too.
One-sided American supply and support of Israel against Palestinian interests has been a central piece in justifying this movement as a jihad, a defense. We provide $10 million per day to Israel in arms. Investment's okay, but it must be in a just and lasting peace and the creation of a long overdue Palestinian state, not to subsidize aggression from either side. Why? Because that resolution is the saw that cuts off a big branch of terrorism, and because it's right.
The first round of this war against terrorism is pulling former enemies together. Look at the cooperation between the U.S. and former USSR. Bush's good buddy, Vladimir Putin, wants to get Russia into the WTO and NATO and cement a claim to Caspian Sea hydrocarbons and get a missile treaty deal worked out. And as a result, he's willing to have the U.S. scratching around in her soft underbelly.
This is a new era and more pieces for the complicated terrorism puzzle.
Interestingly, the lack of bombing targets in Afghanistan is actually an asset for Osama and the Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. They live off the strength of imagery and ideology, not material goods and infrastructure. For many fanatics, like the anarchists and Lenin's crowd of a century ago, affluence and comfort are things that are cast aside. They go grunge while spouting poetic ideology and revolutionary politics and rhetoric. To their primary audience, the oppressed and poor of the world living largely in red and blue, that's moral authority.
Whatever we think of the Taliban regime and its atrocious record of oppression, our counterattack became a sort of terrorism with the deaths of the first innocent civilians and aid workers. Refugee camps full of hopelessness are a perfect breeding ground for the frustration and anger that lead to terrorism.
Millions of young people around the world don't believe their undemocratic regimes will grant them much of a future. They don't see viable niches for themselves. And America's version of orange consumption isn't a solution either. It's been largely imposed from stateside through movies and TV and marketing, rather than grown naturally from within to fit their own cultures.
We're in a different league from most of the rest of the world. The economic loss at the World Trade Center and Pentagon attack, about $100 billion, is larger than the gross national product of 80% of the nations of the world. While pretty tough on New York, it's still just a blip in our national economy. We're symbol of corruption because we're big and prosperous, because we're out of reach, and because we're in their face.
So the big green life conditions have come pounding on our door. We've got to deal with the human element, not just the economics, on an international global scale now.
It means cooperation, and not conflict, strength without aggression.
If we want to deal with terrorism, America's got to give up the isolationist unilateralism to become a participant in environmental treaties like Kyoto and the Durban Conference on Racism and opposing landmines and investing in sustainable development and supporting a world court of justice, not just brokering trade deals for fat cats.
Throughout history, people have formed communities. Communities have become cities. Cities have turned into states. States have formed nations, and nations have come together into multinational alliances. Now, we are challenged with building community again, this time a global community.
The American flags flying everywhere from car antennas and lampposts and T-shirts mark a resurgence of symbolic nationalism. At the same time, immigration has turned defensive again as xenophobia seals our borders.
One day, that will seem quaint as more and more people come to see themselves as citizens of the world, rather than of particular nations.
If we are to survive in this age of globalism, and some form of globalism is inevitable, we will need to shift from exclusive or to more inclusive and, citizens of a global village and our homeland.
It's not a one-world village yet. What purportedly began with the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan can easily become a broader culture war.
It's already spilling over fragile religious fault lines and destabilizing some nations.
In Nigeria, the battle between Islam and Christianity has escalated sharply. The Balkans, where Osama has spent time with the Albanians in Kosovo, are likely to erupt again. Indonesia, the Philippines, China, and Afghanistan's big trading partners, Iran and Pakistan, are all feeling the repercussions of American superpower reacting to terrorism.
President Musharraf's shaky government is largely sidelined in military planning. Pakistan and India have nuclear weapons, and further destabilization around Kashmir could have consequences far greater than the losses in New York and Washington.
Samuel Huntington, in Clash of Civilizations, says, "It's my hypothesis that the fundamental source of conflict in this new world will not be primarily ideological or primarily economic. The great divisions among humankind and the dominating source of conflict will be cultural. The clash of civilizations will dominate global politics." He claims that a velvet curtain, like the old Iron Curtain in Europe, hangs between the West and Islam.
Yeah, but whenever I hear the words "in the Muslim world" or "fundamentalist Muslims" or "the Islamic perspective" or "Islamic terrorists," I just substitute the word "Christian" or "Jewish" or "Buddhist."
In the eyes of Christians, Jewish extremists are fundamentalist Buddhist terrorists. In the Western view, or militant Quakers.
Our language can take us pretty far off base when we lump people together into stereotypes or make sweeping generalizations and charges like Jerry Falwell and a closed-minded mullah might.
It's been far too easy to turn fundamentalist Islam into fanatical, deranged extremism.
We take warped shreds of understanding and generalize them across the whole of the Muslim world. We've not taken into account the multitudinous cultural differences in the many societies that embrace Islam, including our own.
Or that some terrorists just happen to be Muslims. They're not Muslim terrorists any more than Timothy McVeigh was a Christian terrorist.
It's like saying the right-to-life extremists who bomb abortion clinics or the Ku Klux Klan represent all Christianity, or that it's theist terrorists who keep Northern Ireland in turmoil.
We're involved in something far more complex than a racialist or religious war between the West and the Arab world, as Huntington is charged, or even a simple confrontation between modernity and ancient tradition.
Edward Said criticizes Huntington's views as a racist generalization about an Islam that he knows little about. In his article in The Nation magazine entitled "The Clash of Ignorance," Said says, quote, "Huntington is an ideologist, someone who wants to make civilizations and identities into what they are not, shut down, sealed off entities that have been purged of the myriad currents and cross-currents that animate history." Quote, he says that history is not only, quote, "wars of religion and imperial conquest, but also one of exchange and cross-fertilization and sharing. This is the problem with unedifying labels like Islam and the West. They mislead and confuse the mind. What we're dealing with in reality is the interconnectedness of innumerable lives, ours as well as theirs."
To his credit, the president has tried to maintain distinctions between terrorists and Muslims and Arab Americans. 9/11 is not a matter of people of the book, Islamic, Christian, or Jewish, or any other spiritual tradition. It's a matter of how different thinking systems operate, especially around energized zones and the transitions between red and blue and orange, and how they draw religion to them.
For example, though, again, he's wrapped himself in fascist theology and theocracy, Osama bin Laden isn't qualified to speak for Islam. Yet U.S. actions have positioned him and radical mullahs like Omar of the Taliban to call for attacks by the faithful against infidels and corrupt aggressors, their way of framing us. Blue polarity, once activated, has deadly effect.
Even if the Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and other terrorist leaders are captured or killed, plenty of others will step into their shadows, which will only grow larger with their deaths. Martyrdom is glorious in the Shiite view.
Americans aren't prepared to deal with any people who live for death in a righteous cause more than life in a prosperous world.
A few more misguided missiles with the requisite non-combatant casualties will rally even more opposition to the murderous Americans, from both kinfolk and like believers. Osama bin Laden, like Saddam, is being positioned to reach far beyond Al-Qaeda and to be a leader of holy warriors and disenfranchised peoples around the world.
One thing we need to do is to be providing contrary messages from proper, rightful, higher authority, the way you talk the blue.
not our propagandists or PR hacks. We've got to confuse the blue true believers. We should call an emergency conference of world religious leaders to separate God's will and man's wants from terrorism, and then put maximum effort into getting that word out.
Religion is probably an adaptive survival mechanism built into human nature. Therefore, we have to focus on it, as well as politics and economics, if we expect to combat terrorism. This is far less a war of religions or cultures than a war between blue and orange for dominance in lands full of purple and red.
And those describe the life conditions of Afghanistan. It's a pretty rough neighborhood.
Incredibly harsh is an understatement. The weather ranges from extremely hot to extremely cold, with sandstorms and lots of dust, a lesson Western video journalists learn quickly when their equipment ground to a halt shortly after arrival.
The Afghan people are fierce and hospitable, tough as the caracol sheep that survive on their parched ground. Yet after 26 years of war and drought, the civilian population is almost wholly dependent for sustenance on the international aid community.
Afghanistan was already at a tipping point before 9/11. Small, seemingly innocuous actions can have huge consequences on people who just can't withstand any deterioration to their life conditions. 7 out of 27 million will soon be starving.
1 out of every 3 children is an orphan. 47% of males are over 15 are literate, with a life expectancy of 43, compared to 74 for us. 15% of females over 15 are literate, with a life expectancy of 44 years, 77 for us. CIA says that 97% of the U.S. population can read and write, though that's debatable.
In Afghanistan, life is short, nasty, and brutish. We're setting them up for a wintertime catastrophe. Food is the infrastructure. It's a strategic element for both sides in this war, so the Red Cross is at risk. Our made-for-TV airdrops of peanut butter, MREs, land in minefields. There are more mines than people in Afghanistan, and they kill and maim roughly 4,000 every month.
We have contributed heavily to the international relief effort in Afghanistan for a long time, but we shut it down a few weeks ago. Now we've got to quickly increase and accelerate it along with the other NGOs.
Trying to starve out bin Laden and the Taliban will also starve out millions of children and other innocent people.
The low literacy rate in Afghanistan means that Afghans rely largely on storytelling to share history, culture, and learning.
Because of multiple languages and an isolated tribal way of life in much of the country, their divisions and hierarchies based on bloodlines, extended family and territory, strong purple and warlord red, along with the overarching Islamic blue.
But Afghans pulled together to repel the British and Soviet invading armies. Unless the U.S. is extremely skillful, the external enemy effect will again unify the Afghans against us more than divide them. Either way, after this quote war unquote ends, nation building is going to be incredibly difficult.
And language is a factor as well. The two official languages are Pashto and Dari, Afghan Persian, and there's lots of bilingualism.
And there are 30 minor languages, with Uzbek and Turkmen spoken by about 10% of the population.
Afghanistan has one television for every 270 people. We've got almost one TV per person here. They've got one radio for every 161 people. Meanwhile, we have two per person. They have one AM and one FM station, along with shortwave broadcasts in Pashto, Dari, Urdu, and English.
We would do far better to saturate the country with wind-up shortwave radios and start dropping in ideas instead of cluster bombs.
The CIA says there's no legal system, although Afghans tacitly agree they follow Islamic law.
The UN says the municipal and provincial authorities follow the Taliban's interpretation of Islamic law, plus their traditional tribal codes of justice.
Afghanistan has some small industry, including carpet making. The big business is agriculture, especially poppies.
Safe drinking water reaches only about 12% of the population, and the recent drought may reduce that figure.
Health services are available to only 29% of the total population.
So, Afghanistan has experienced profound shifts on the spiral, and it's in multiple gamma regressions and transitions.
Only a decade ago, Afghan women played important roles in public life in a country that had modern attitudes. They constituted 40% of the doctors in the capital, 50% of the civilian government workers, and 70% of the teachers. They could vote. Kabul was a cosmopolitan city.
Now Afghans have been deprived of both human and cultural rights. The Taliban gang has eliminated with edict and their artillery whatever they consider graven images. Packaged goods can't even include animals or women on their labels.
Since the militants took power in Kabul in 1996 and implemented gender apartheid, women have not been allowed to leave their homes unless accompanied by a male relative. They have to wear a burqa, which covers their entire head and body when they're in public. Otherwise, they risk stoning. 5 women often have to share a single burqa, since they're pretty expensive by Afghan standards, and those things aren't designed for modern urban life. The most common accident is women being hit by cars because the narrow mesh window is just too small to see through. Under domination of the misogynistic Taliban, women are forbidden to work or go to school.
The Northern Alliance, our ostensible coalition partner, has been every bit as brutal as the Taliban, and also engaged in crimes against humanity, according to Human Rights Watch.
Robert Fisk argues in London's The Independent that the Northern Alliance are gangsters who in the 90s looted and raped their way through the suburbs of Kabul. They chose girls for forced marriages and murdered their families.
RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of Women of Afghanistan, opposed the Northern Alliance, criticizing them as anti-female, anti-democracy, anti-civilization, and violent. Are we going to end up propping up another brutal regime?
Since the beginning of our involvement in the 1970s with the Mujahideen, the CIA has spent roughly $1.5 billion to fight communism, which resulted in protection for the drug trade. In 2001, the U.S. administration gave $43 million to the Taliban to pay them to stop growing opium. And production has gone up tenfold in recent weeks. More blowback, I guess.
The UN says there are over 1 million opium farmers there now, the largest single source of employment in the country. Powerful tribal warlords who long used the CIA's support to finance their expansion. 96.5% of the drug market is now controlled by the Taliban, and the Northern Alliance, our colleagues, pick up the slack.
Afghanistan is the world's number one source for heroin, a pipeline we need to shut down, given the possibilities of slipping biological weapons directly into one of our most vulnerable population groups.
Part of the solution for terrorism is to saturate, satiate, and support places like Afghanistan with food, medicine, educational tools, not propaganda, and opportunities for developing legitimate trade. They have to have more than they need, so corrupt regimes lose power and influence over a population liberated from hunger, fear, ignorance, and purposelessness.
Women and their energy must have a central role in revitalizing civil society. We need to stop the attacks that hurt the people of Afghanistan and concentrate on tracking down terrorist criminals and apprehending them with all means necessary under international law, not vigilante justice.
We don't help people get moving through the spiral toward the second tier by bombing or starving the lower levels of the first out of existence.
So, on this tape, we've touched on democracy in America and foreign affairs, or and logic, our addiction to fossil fuels, our military crutch, today's President Bush as a leader, the role of the media, the impact of religious heritage, the nature of existence problems, as well as life in Afghanistan. What it comes down to is this. We have to get beyond our current ways of thinking and solving problems.
We're going to have to live together in a sustainable and peaceful way so that the diversity of our human species can continue.
We have to find solutions that set the foundation for life in 5 years and 5,000 years.
To do that, it's essential to stretch our leadership beyond blue and orange masquerading as complex thinking and awaken the awareness of green, yellow, and turquoise problems and solutions at those levels.
Terrorism must end, but so must the things that produce it.
And we have to consider all the biopsychosocial components. Life conditions, genetics, mind capacities, nutrition, diverse values, cultures, worldviews, the whole thing.
That means more than just shifting policies. It means a redefinition of what sustainable security is, and a change in human nature. Our objective is not fighting terrorism in perpetuity, but immunizing our world against it quickly, then eradicating it for good.
To do that, we can't think in isolation or nationalism. In the interlinked information age, we can't do something in one part of the world without the waves rolling back over us, culturally, socially, emotionally, ecologically, economically, and spiritually.
We need a generation that knows better than war, not one program to handle it. 9/11 and the American response to it are a wake-up call for the whole world.
What a day it will be when an entire generation, worldwide, knows only peace and chooses to live sustainably.
We all share this big, beautiful ball together. All the systems of the spiral live upon it.
The forms they take, though, is up to us. Without a quick change in course, both the planet and the spiral are in serious danger of collapse.
Dr. Graves once said, "I do suggest, and this I deeply believe is so, that for the overall welfare of total man's existence in this world, over the long run of time, higher levels are better than lower levels, and that the prime good of any society's governing figures should be to promote human movement up the levels of human existence.
We agree, and also that those governing figures must be ahead of the curve and not lagging behind it.
We're facing green and yellow existential problems.
And that means more green and yellow thinking to manage the complexities at hand, not a regression to blue authoritarianism or a drive for orange forcible development of more conspicuous consumers.
The world must move forward and not back. Let's focus on moving ourselves up the levels of human existence along with everyone else.
So it is time to consciously evolve toward embodying the real meaning behind being a global villager, patriotism, where patria means more than the homeland, it means the whole earth.
We hope you found this tape useful. For more information on Claire Graves or the Spiral Dynamics model, go to www.clarewgraves.com, that's clarewgraves.com, and www.spiraldynamics.org. Or if you'd like to email us, or if you have comments, questions, if you'd like additional tapes, or if you want more information, email us at comments@spiraldynamics.org.